The Born Against essay on hobby programming communities and LLM resistance is the story I've been thinking about most today. The piece, by Michael Fogus, takes its title from a punk band and argues that hobby programming communities, Demoscene, interactive fiction, game jam culture, competitive programming, are increasingly and deliberately positioning themselves against LLM tooling, not out of ignorance, but out of a principled commitment to a particular kind of craft experience.
The argument resonates with me because it surfaces a distinction that gets lost in the productivity-focused discourse around AI coding tools. For a professional writing production code, the question is almost purely instrumental. Does this tool help me ship reliable software faster? For a hobbyist making a Nintendo 64 game in 2026, the question is entirely different. The process is the point. The constraint solving, the dead ends, the moment when the sprite finally renders correctly, that experience is not a means to an end. It is the end.
And this connects directly to the Nintendo 64 development story, which is the Phobos Lab piece on making Xibalba 64. This is a genuinely impressive technical feat, a Doom-like game running on real N64 hardware, written with deep knowledge of the RCP, the Reality Coprocessor, and the constraints of a 4-megabyte cartridge and 33 megahertz CPU. The developer goes into extraordinary detail about display lists, microcode, texture compression, and the specific ways you have to think to get anything to run smoothly on hardware that predates modern GPU abstractions by 30 years.
The reason this story is trending isn't nostalgia. Well, not only nostalgia. It's because the skills required to build for original N64 hardware are genuinely difficult and genuinely rare. And the write-up is a beautiful piece of technical documentation. For a community that worries about skill atrophy in an age of AI-assisted everything, this is a kind of proof that deep, low-level technical craftsmanship persists and produces remarkable things.
The Crime Pays But Botany Doesn't reading list is a very different kind of cultural artifact. The blog, run by a botanist whose handle gives the name away, is a curated list of books about plants, natural history, and the economics of scientific work. The title is a pointed observation about research funding that the legal and financial infrastructure society has built rewards certain kinds of work richly and treats natural science as an afterthought. 266 points and 105 comments, which is a tribute to how the HN community responds when someone writes with genuine passion and clarity about a domain they love.
The Blade Runner title card's analysis is another piece in this genre of loving, obsessive craft attention. The author has done a careful study of the typography, color grading, and compositional choices in Ridley Scott's 1982 film's title cards. And the argument is that those brief text moments, Los Angeles, November 2019, do an extraordinary amount of narrative work that's easy to miss because it's so precisely calibrated. The HN discussion pulls in typographers, cinematographers, and people who have simply watched the film 40 times, and the quality of the conversation is everything.
Nashville's eminent domain action against the planned data center near the Nashville Zoo deserves more attention than it's gotten in mainstream tech coverage. The city council invoked eminent domain, the government's power to take private property for public use with compensation, to block a data center project that had already cleared private land acquisition. The mechanism is unusual. Eminent domain is typically used to acquire land for public projects, roads, parks, schools, using it defensively to prevent a private development the community has decided it doesn't want is a less common application that will likely face legal challenge.
The substantive issue is the data center infrastructure build-out that's been accelerating across American cities and suburbs. Data centers require enormous amounts of power. A large hyperscale facility can consume more electricity than a small city and generate very few local jobs relative to their footprint. The zoo proximity is partly about aesthetics and partly about real concerns. Noise, light pollution, water consumption for cooling, and the strain on local power grids. Nashville's action may be the first of many as municipalities start developing more sophisticated regulatory responses to data center siting.
There's also a wonderful piece on Morioka Shoten, the Tokyo bookstore that sells exactly one book at a time. The store concept is that each week they choose a single title, fill the space with it, and host events around the author. It's an extreme curation philosophy that's the opposite of the algorithmic abundance model that dominates how we encounter information now. The fact that it's on HN with any traction at all says something about the appetite in this community for thoughtful curation as an antidote to infinite scroll.
The Pareto front. Wikipedia entry appearing on HN is a bit mysterious at first glance. It's a Wikipedia article about a mathematical concept from multi-objective optimization, not a news story. But in the HN context, it often means someone found it unexpectedly useful or clarifying in a current project, which triggered a small wave of people who had been meaning to properly understand the concept, but never had. The Pareto front is the set of solutions where you can't improve one objective without making another worse. It's the formal description of genuine trade-offs, which is a concept every engineer and policy analyst encounters constantly.
The Hiroshima discovery is genuinely significant. A team of scientists has identified a multi-component alloy, meaning an alloy containing more than five principal elements, that was formed by the thermal and pressure conditions of the atomic bomb detonation on August 6, 1945, which is 81 years ago today. The material has properties that weren't achievable through conventional metallurgy at the time, and studying it provides both historical documentation of the blast conditions and potentially useful insights into high-entropy alloy formation.
The Quantego Project, Lego models of IBM quantum computers, is a charming educational initiative. The models are accurate enough to use in demonstrations and classroom settings, which addresses a real challenge in quantum computing education. The actual hardware is inaccessible and visually abstract. Having a tactile, buildable model of a dilution refrigerator that's accurate at the system level gives students something to reason about spatially. IBM's involvement in making the plans available speaks well of their science education commitment.
The IBM I password hash reconstruction piece is a security archaeology story. A researcher has reverse engineered the QSIRUPD password hash format used in IBM's AS or 400 and IBM I systems, demonstrating that historical password hashes from these systems, which are still deployed in significant numbers in banking, insurance, and government, can be attacked more efficiently than previously understood. IBM I systems are often overlooked in security reviews because they're legacy infrastructure that just works, which makes this kind of focused security research disproportionately valuable.
And the discovery loop, which is the highest scoring story today at 775 points and 487 comments, appears to be a tool or platform for structured learning and discovery that someone in the HN community has been building. The massive comment count suggests it's either solving a deeply felt problem or touching a nerve about how people navigate information overload, possibly both.
Now, I want to spend the second half of this segment on something that I think the HN coverage of this week's AI stories invites us to challenge, and it connects to both the Castform result and the LLM's Can't Jump paper. The emerging consensus in the AI infrastructure community right now is that frontier model quality is such a decisive factor in real-world AI applications that the cost differential between frontier and open models is acceptable, that organizations should pay for GPT 5.6 or Claude-level models because the quality gap is too large to close with engineering.
And the Castform result is the sharpest challenge to that consensus I've seen this quarter. They're not claiming open models are better in general. They're claiming that for retrieval specifically, a well-engineered pipeline with an open model beats a naive frontier model deployment by a significant margin at 1% of the cost. If that result holds up, the implication is that the quality gap is real, but the consensus overestimates how much of the gap is model quality versus retrieval and pipeline design.
So here's the what if we're wrong version of this. What if the assumption that frontier model capability is the binding constraint in most enterprise AI deployments is systematically incorrect? What if the actual binding constraint is, in most cases, retrieval quality, context management, and output evaluation, and frontier model capability is largely being purchased as insurance against a quality ceiling that most applications never actually approach?
The strongest version of the counter-argument is that benchmarks like the one Castform used are narrow by construction. Retrieval tasks have a ground truth that's easy to evaluate. Reasoning tasks, nuanced summarization, creative generation, multi-step planning, these are much harder to evaluate and much harder to substitute with retrieval engineering. The frontier model capability is insurance. Argument might be correct for retrieval while being wrong for the applications where frontier models are actually earning their cost.
Which means the question becomes, what fraction of actual enterprise AI workloads are fundamentally retrieval-heavy versus reasoning-heavy? And the honest answer is that most organizations don't have that breakdown. They're deploying frontier models for a mix of workloads without a clear understanding of which tasks need frontier capability and which don't.
If we're wrong, if frontier model quality is genuinely the binding constraint even for retrieval tasks, and the cast form result is an artifact of their specific benchmark design, the thing to watch for is replication. If two or three other teams with different evaluation methodologies and different retrieval workload distributions reproduce results in the same range, the signal is real. If the result turns out to be idiosyncratic to Neon's specific query patterns, that's important too. The next 6 months of independent retrieval benchmarking will be telling.
And the LLM's can't jump paper is the other side of the same coin. If the compositional generalization critique is correct, then self-improvement loops and complex agentic systems built on LLM cores have a fundamental ceiling that no amount of scaling will overcome. If that claim turns out to be wrong or overstated, if the right training regime or architecture change can actually produce genuine compositional generalization, then the self-improvement work from Prime Intellect and others becomes much more significant than its current reception suggests.
The signal to watch for there is whether compositional generalization benchmarks improve with scale on the specific tasks the paper flags as failures. If they don't improve, the critique stands. If they do, the question becomes whether it's generalization or clever pattern matching at a finer granularity, and distinguishing between those two is genuinely hard.